Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all out here this morning. We're going to take a quick pause. I've been doing Colossians at the 9 o'clock hour, but we're going to pause that and get back to it next week and finish it off. Today, I want to talk about something else that I've seen kind of floating around. I want to make an addressing of that. At our 9 o'clock hour, Brother Will brought us a lesson, a great lesson on love. And I want to talk a little bit about an extension of that, and that is proper and righteous judgment. So, of course, our text is going to end up in Matthew chapter 7, where Jesus talks about this. But I want to begin with an illustration, and let's move in that direction as we go towards the end. One of my favorite pieces, probably arguably my favorite pieces of American architecture, is the Golden Gate Bridge. It is an incredible structure, and if you have been there, I'm incredibly jealous of you. I long to be there someday. The Golden Gate Bridge was finished in 1937. It's dedication to American ingenuity and intelligence and beauty. And when you're going across this bridge, right, if you go from the bridge part down into the San Francisco Bay, it's 220 feet of air between you and hitting the water. Now, the best way for you to cross the Golden Gate Bridge is the same way that you cross any bridge, the way it was intended. Right across there, they show you the path. This is where you go. If you see someone decide, I don't really like the way that bridge is going, I'm going to instead drive off the left side of it because I think that way is better, they plunge 220 feet to their doom. That's it. If you say that person going off the side and say, well, actually what I want to do is I don't want to go the way they went, I'm going to go instead off to the right side, you aren't saving yourself any trouble. You're going off the wrong way. The best way to go over the Golden Gate Bridge and cross the San Francisco Bay is the way it was intended, the way the builders told you to go, right across. So this is going to be our illustration this morning, because we see a world plunging off the left side of the bridge. They're going into what we would say is unrighteousness, that they are seeing what God has said, and they are rebelling against it. They're going to do whatever they want to do. They want to just commit all sorts of evil. So they just charge right off the left side of the bridge. I don't want to go down the way that God's called me to do. So then the temptation is to look at the people going off the left side of the bridge and say, at least I'm not like them. At least I'm a better person than them. At least I've got everything together. And we don't think about Jesus in that at all. We think about ourselves and how great we are. And what we do is we plunge off the right side of the bridge into self-righteousness. But as we just illustrated, both of those lead to doom. There is one right way and one single way to assure our safety, and that is going down the middle, the path that has been laid out to us by our God. So using the Golden Gate Bridge as our illustration this morning, I want to talk about two examples, two stories about improper, unfair, unrighteous judgment, and then bring us back to Matthew chapter 7 and have Jesus finish this off. So you want to begin in Joshua. We're going to be turning over to Joshua chapter 6. Likely a story that you're very familiar with. An important one nonetheless. We are getting very close here to the Israelite conquering of the people. That they are supposed to go into this land. They are told, this is a judgment. This is also your inheritance. This is what you're supposed to do. So we're on the last day of the conquering of Jericho. And we're going to see a combination, most importantly, I think, of God's righteous promises. But we're also going to see the Israelite reaction to the stories we get into chapter 7. So if you begin with me, we're going to read Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 15. On the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day, and they marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you, keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing of destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown. And as soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, sheep, oxen, sheep, and donkeys, with the edge of the sword. But to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, "Go into the prostitute's house, and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her, as you have sworn to her." So young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged with her. And they brought all her relatives and put them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and everything in it. Only the silver and the gold and the vessels of bronze and of iron they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Joshua laid an oath on them at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds the city Jericho. At the cost of the firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son shall he set up his gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all of the land. But the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go up and spy out the land." And the men went up and spied out Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few." So about 3,000 men went up there from the people, and they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them as far as the gate, as far as Sherebim, and struck them at the descent. And the hearts of the people melted and became as water. So, as we get into the story, we begin with God establishing what you're supposed to do when you enter into Jericho. God has provided for the people through the wilderness. He has strengthened them. He is making them into this fighting warrior nation. But it is not up to Israel for the fact they've gotten there. It's not all on them. So it makes sense that when God says, this is the first place you are destroying, this first place that you're entering, these things belong to me. Makes perfect sense. This battle plan, this strategy is probably, if God is not on your side, the worst battle strategy of all time. You don't just walk around things and they fall over. So again, Israel is entirely reliant on the power of God to capture this, to get anything. But we see, just as God promises the people that when you do this, the walls will fall, they fall down. And we also see that Rahab, as she has dealt faithfully with the people of Israel, she is treated with fairness. That God spares her and her entire family. So, just from this passage, we see a God who is faithful to his promises. And that is extremely comforting. Knowing that when we act in faithful ways, when we do and act in obedience, he will be faithful to that. Then the problem enters in chapter 7. Because we realize that the people of Israel are not all that faithful to God. They are plunging off the left side of the bridge, if you will, into unrighteousness. It begins with Achan, who takes a cloak and he takes some gold. Because clearly, in Achan's mind, he's not considering, well, God is actually the one who has taken down this structure and taken down the stronghold. Clearly, it was me and my voice. Who knows what exactly Achan was thinking, but These are things that I want, that I see. I'm going to take them, rebel against the word of God, and bury them in my tent. But Achan isn't the only one who is faithless. As the battle plan for Ai is being drawn up, Joshua sends over some messengers to just check out Ai, see what's going on there. And when they return, there is no consultation of God. There is no asking him, well, what are we supposed to do here? You were the one who provided for us at Jericho. How do we handle this situation at Ai? Instead, they come back and they arrogantly assume, oh, we took care of Jericho. Just send 3,000 people up there. We'll take out Ai, no problem. They forgot that the battle was not theirs to begin with. They were unfaithful. And so as they go up there, they send their 3,000 men. They get driven back by this tiny city of Ai. A totally embarrassing just loss in their favor. And their hearts melt. So it's easy for us to read a story like this and we see, oh, look at how Achan acted. Look at how Israel acted. We don't want to act like them. We don't want to hear the words of the Lord enter into our ears and decide, absolutely not, I'm going to reject that. And that's good. We need to, whenever God speaks to us, repent of whatever we're doing or just follow him and go in the direction that he tells us to go. But the dangerous side comes in when we don't want to fall off that edge so bad that we decide that we're actually so good we don't need to listen to God in a different direction. I want to give an example of this with the book of Jonah, if you'd like to turn there. Jonah, and we're going to begin in chapter 3. The story of Jonah is extremely popular, but I do want to just quickly review what happens before we get to this passage. Jonah has been called by God to go to Nineveh. And in response to being told to go to this evil people and tell them, Jonah decides to run away. He's going to get on a boat and try to flee as far as possible. God sends a storm, and that storm results in Jonah going down into the sea, where God rescues him, tells him, you're still going to go on this mission that I've told you to do, is spat up near Nineveh, and he's told, you go into the city and you tell them what I tell you to tell them. As a result of Jonah's preaching, if you want to call it that, as a result of this, all of Nineveh repents. The king of Nineveh is literally in sackcloth and ashes. He is incredibly humble before God. And how does God respond to that? But in chapter 3 and verse 10, when God saw what they did, how they turned from their evil way, God relented of the disaster that he said he would do to them, and he did not do it. Picking up in chapter 4. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That this is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. And the Lord said, do you do well to be angry? Jonah went out of the city and sat to the east of the city and made a booth for himself there. He sat under it in the shade till he should see what would become of the city. Now the Lord God appointed a plant and made it come up over Jonah that it might be a shade over his head to save him from his discomfort. So Jonah was exceedingly glad because of the plant. But when dawn came the next day, God appointed a worm that attacked the plant so that it withered. When the sun rose, God appointed a scorching east wind, and the sun beat down on the head of Jonah, so that he was faint. And he asked that he might die and said, it is better for me to die than to live. But God said to Jonah, do you do well to be angry for the plant? And he said, yes, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die. And the Lord said, you pay the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle. We begin the story with the mercy of God, which has been extended throughout this whole thing. God has extended mercy to the mariners on the boat. He's extended mercy to Jonah, who tried to jump away and die to escape from him. He's shown mercy to the people of Nineveh. And in response to God's incredible mercy, Jonah does what seems unthinkable. He's angry at it. God, this is why I didn't want to come out here in the first place. Because I knew when I came out here, you were going to be a good God. You are going to show your steadfast love. You are going to relent from your disaster. In Jonah's anger, it's like, well, those are things you should be rejoicing in. Those are things we have hope in, knowing that we are not destroyed because God is a merciful God who loves us and shows compassion. But Jonah did not care about them. He didn't care about the Ninevites. He cared about himself. And because of that, he set himself up and said, I deserve the good things that come from God. They don't. God gives this living parable for him, an illustration in his real life, where he has a plant that he didn't do anything for, that God causes to grow up over him. And Jonah is relaxing. He's chilling in the shade, and he is thinking, this is wonderful. I'm so glad this happened to me, because I deserve it, rightfully. But then when the plant dies and the sun beats down on him, then he's angry at the Lord and he wants to die because he is so insistent, there's no way this should be happening to me. Jonah has made a lot of assumptions, primarily the one that he is the righteous one and they over there are the bad ones. Therefore, he deserves the good from God and they do not. One of the problems with self-righteousness and the danger of it is, I see them over there as undeserving of the compassion of God. I deserve it. And what that does is it transforms us not from being people who are actually following God, but into gods ourselves. That is a very destructive pattern, one we must avoid. So this is what, these two thoughts are what bring us to Matthew chapter 7. We're going to finish up our lesson here this morning. Matthew chapter 7. In verse 1, we have a passage that is very widely known in our culture. Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. So, there are a lot of people who will say, only God can judge me. They use just those first two words, judge not. Don't tell me what I'm doing is evil. Don't tell me what I'm doing is immoral. Don't tell me there's a right way to do things. I want to do me. But there can be an overcorrection to hearing a world saying, judge not. And that is, read even less and say, judge. All I'm going to do is point to your evil, and I'm never going to have to look at my own. The problem with a lot of what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount is it calls out every single person. We cannot simply look at the sinner and say, look at them, completely unrepentant, I'm glad I'm not like them, because he calls us out too. Commonly when we do that, we are making ourselves the standard instead of God himself. So I want us to go back through these six verses and understand what Jesus is trying to teach us here about fair and righteous judgment. Because the people who read this passage as judge not, they don't want to be called out for their evil. The people who read this passage judge want to point their fingers so they aren't called out for their evil. Just say, look over there. Jesus calls instead to look in our own hearts. And then that's going to change our actions and our judgment from there. So, Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment that you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use it, it will be measured to you. Is this saying judge or judge not? Instead, when you judge, it should be with a righteous judgment. He tells us that the standard by which we will be judged is the one we hold other people to. I think if we're all honest with ourselves, if we held ourselves up to the scrutiny that we hold other people to, we'd fail that. But we make a lot of assumptions in thinking that we're the righteous ones and we're the good ones. What every Christian needs to understand is that we are utterly dependent on the mercy of God. So, I need to trust in Him. I need to show mercy because I have been shown mercy. An example I want everybody to think about. Perhaps this summer you remember there was a submarine that got destroyed. And there was a lot of neglect, a lot of things that went into that situation. But the narrative around that was really awful. Because what happened was there were a lot of people who went down to the submarine, they spent a lot of money to get on there. They had to be like really, really elite, rich level of people to get there. So what happened was, if you're a Christian, I hope you were praying for them, that as slim of the chances it seemed like they would make it out, you were praying for them. But there were a lot of people who were genuinely overjoyed to see people dying. They were genuinely overjoyed, hoping that their death was long and that they were running out of oxygen and panicking. If you didn't see that, I did. And it was horrifying. People are always, always pro-love when it's the people they like. But the second they become their enemy or someone they don't like, that usually goes out the window. The standard we have set before us on who we are supposed to love is Christ, who loved all of us even while we hated Him, even as we were His enemies. Seeing that He is our standard of righteousness and goodness, we cannot put ourselves in that place. So seeing that we are not Him, we are to extend mercy. That is the duty of the Christian. And if we hope to be judged with mercy, we need to be extending it. And this is what takes us into this next passage, helping us with Jesus' illustration. Because He's going to use one that's pretty funny, but it's funny to make a point. If you want to read verses 3 through 5 with me. "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and you will be able to see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." So, Jesus, perhaps looking around, sees a tree and says, "You know how foolish this improper judgment and biased judgment that humans act is? It's like having a literal tree stuck through your head." Could you imagine how inconvenient your life would be? You can't walk into most of the places that you would hope to. Anytime you turn your head, you're accidentally knocking out dozens of people. But also, half of your head is occupied. You have one good eye, and you can't see anything that's going on over here. And then you go over to somebody else. You see they got some sleep from last night. And you're going to go walk over them and try to fix them. It's an absurd image. It's ridiculous. But that's how it is. When we, not even looking at ourselves and seeing, by what standard am I judging? How am I acting in my own life? Let me go and fix somebody else. It's ridiculous. If we took Jesus' lesson here to heart, our congregations would be radically different. Incredibly and wonderfully different. I want to give an example. Let's say that there's someone in your congregation who frustrates you because it kind of seems like every time you're in a conversation with them or you hear them with somebody else, They're talking over them. They don't let anybody finish. They're just like super expressive and they never listen. But before you ever go to that person, you say, well, let me think about my own life. Let me even ask questions about to people in my own life. Let me ask my spouse if I just talk over them all the time. Let me ask my kids, do I talk over you all the time? Let me ask my coworkers, other people at church, do I just talk over you? Do you think I listen to you well? And then as you realize, oh man, I'm kind of like that person. I kind of do the same thing. Then you prayerfully work on it and you work on your heart. And as you improve, you start seeing these changes. Then you go up to that person. And when you come to them, it's not, man, you're so annoying. I can't stand the way you talk. Instead, it's, I know where you've been. I've struggled with the same thing and I've been really working on it. You should know that the way that you're behaving, it's not very loving to your family and to your friends. It's not very loving to your church. But as you go on this journey to be better, I'll be right here with you, and I want to do what is most helpful. That is radically different from a lot of times how we handle our problems. Either we just go into a corner and we gossip about them and talk about how annoying and how frustrating they are, or when we finally go to that person, we're just like, Can you stop being the way that you are? Whenever we take Jesus' word seriously, we will be harder workers because before we go and speak to somebody about whatever's going wrong, we're very thoughtful about what's going on in our own hearts. And we're going to be compassionate enough to know if you're battling something that serious, I know what that battle is like. And I want to go through it with you. I want us to mature and I want us to grow together. Unfair judgments are really easy, and they're a sign of complacency. Because instead of understanding, am I walking the right way? Am I walking in the path of life? We're too focused on everybody else, and judging everybody else, and not even on the standard that is right. So we have to take some consideration into that. But then we have verse 6, which kind of seems confusing in what Jesus is trying to say here. Verse 6 says, do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you. So Jesus just goes through this whole section saying there's a proper way to judge, and it's with a good standard and with taking the log out of your own eye. But then he says, don't throw these holy things, these pearls, before these animals. So which is it? Well, there's another part of righteous judgment and fair judgment. Whenever you take a pearl or anything valuable and you put it in front of a pig, they don't care. All they want is mud and food. They couldn't care less about your pearl or how valuable it is or the hard work that it takes or how much time it took. They don't care about a pearl. And in Jesus' day, dogs are very unclean. Nobody really had them domesticated, especially not Israelites. But even in our day, even if with your pet who you love and adore, I'm sure, even they see things in your house that they don't see as valuable, that they're willing to destroy because they're just like, what? It doesn't matter. Jesus is trying to illustrate a point that things that we have given to us by God, our gifts, our compassion, whatever the case may be, those are things that are pearls. They're holy. They can be utilized in a lot of great ways. But there are a lot of people who are not going to appreciate what's holy. There are people who are going to see what you're trying to do and your efforts, and they're just going to mock you for it. And they don't care. And maybe you invest a lot of time in trying to evangelize to them and all this stuff. But there's a time when you just need to let it go. You perhaps aren't the person for that job. Perhaps it wasn't the plan for you to handle this situation. Rather, you continue to pray for them and you see somebody else who needs your help. Another friend, another person at church who needs your encouragement, whatever the case may be. The temptation is, number one, keep working on somebody for forever and they never change their mind, instead of praying and leaving it up to God. Or we see, well, that person has rejected me. I'm going to hold on to my pearls and never give them out to anybody. And that's wrong too. Part of righteous judgment is learning to be discerning. Who is going to hear this message? Who is going to treat it fairly? In response to that, who do I give these pearls to so that they can come closer to the Lord and have greater maturity in Him? That is what righteous judgment is about. So whenever you read this passage and you hear somebody who's just using it as a judge not, don't tell me anything wrong, understand that's wrong. But if you're also using it to just point your finger and say, I'm allowed to judge anybody, make sure that your judgment that you're using isn't your own biased, flawed judgment, and instead the righteous way of God. As I mentioned before, the Golden Gate Bridge, someday I hope to drive over it. It's an incredible bridge, an incredible structure. But even at right now, where I am right now, all I can do is glance, oh man, I'm way behind, my bad. All I can do is see incredible pictures of it and enjoy it. But it's not until I finally drive on it that I see the beauty of what it really is and the purpose of what it really is. The same thing goes for the way of God. That is not until we're finally walking on it how we see how much superior it is than to our own way or the ways of the world. So it's important for us that we are not overly critical to the point of becoming unrighteous in our judgment towards one another, and that we aren't pursuing evil. Rather, we are going down the way that leads us home. I'm hopeful this has been helpful for you. Perhaps you've seen that a lot and you don't know how to respond or how we should handle that rightly. And I'm hopeful that this text draws you into a deeper understanding of your accountability before God and towards your neighbor. Now, the way home is only found in Jesus, the one who loves you, the one who died for you, the one who was raised for you. So if you have not committed your life to Him, why do you wait? And if you have fallen off the path, either way, if you're struggling to find the way home, we're here to help you. We want to serve you in any way that we can. So I'm hopeful these thoughts will be with you as we prepare for our singing. And if there's any time you need us or any help, please let us know. And with that, we'll be led in our invitation song.